Good afternoon and welcome to the Fall 2012 Encore Lecture. My name is Carl Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of Chesterton House, the sponsor of this afternoon's lecture. Chesterton House is a Christian study center at Cornell and an affiliate member of Cornell United Religious Work, as well as a member of the consortium of Christian Study Center. It's my privilege to introduce this afternoon's speaker. Chesterton House has been sponsoring a number of distinguished lecturers since 2000 in collaboration with a variety of academic departments at Cornell. And the Bind For Lecture is a lecture series designed to address issues of faith in a pluralistic society. It's made possible by Cornell alumnus Carl Noyce and his wife Elaine, and is in honor of the late Al Bind For and his wife Linda. We're very grateful to them for their support of Chesterton House and of Cornell. You may have noticed that we had an election recently, and as happens every 4 years around this time, and even in between from time to time, there are a lot of reflections on the nature of religion and public life in America, and about what is unique and different about America in particular vis-a-vis Europe. And there is a long history to these reflections that goes back at least to the Tocqueville and beyond. And in fact, there happens to be a book on the history of this topic. And it's the author of that book that we have with us today. The book is entitled God in the Atlantic, and it's by Tal Howard of Wharton College. Tal Howard is the Stephen Phillips Chair of History at Wharton College. He has a PhD in European Intellectual History from the University of Virginia. He's also been affiliated with Valparaiso University, the Humboldt University of Berlin, University of Basel, University of Notre Dame. His books include Religion and the Rise of Historicism, on the Theological Origins of 19th Century Historical Consciousness, Protestant Theology and the Making of the Modern German University, a 2006 title from Oxford Press, and most recently, God in the Atlantic, subtitled America, Europe, and the Religious Divide, which came out last year, also from Oxford Press. His articles, essays, and reviews have appeared in a wide variety of academic journals, including the American Historical Review, the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, the Journal of the History of Ideas, and the Journal of Church and State. So it's a great privilege to have with us today, Professor Tal Howard. Please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Well, it's an honor and pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank Carl and the folks at Chesterton House for making this possible, and the Bind For family for establishing this lectureship in the first place. And I should say that my wife is actually a townie, grew up here in Ithaca, was an undergrad at Cornell, so I have a lot of affection for this institution. Actually, her name, maiden name, was Sagan, and I met her in the University of Virginia. I thought for a year this must be Carl Sagan's daughter studying with me at the University of Virginia. Turns out to be a complete coincidence. But what I want to do this afternoon is summarize aspects of the book just mentioned, God in the Atlantic. It's of course a fool's errand to try to summarize a book in the space of an hour. But in thinking about how to go about this, I decided I would heed the advice that I often give to my students, and that's that you should be able to state the thesis of your paper in one sentence. Like my students, I found this would be very difficult, so I've allowed myself the prerogative of two sentences. I'll give you here the beginning. Thesis. While we often speak of a common Atlantic or Western civilization that encompasses Europe, Western Europe, and the United States, we also need to keep in mind that historically viewed, there are significant and abiding religious differences between the continents, the so-called Old World and the New World. To better understand transatlantic relations and some of the disaffections and misunderstanding that comes up from time to time, one needs to keep in mind what I call in the book an Atlantic gap or a God gap between Western Europe and the United States, especially in religious matters. So, two fairly long sentences. and probably many of you have had just a common experience of traveling to various places in Europe, and you see many cathedrals and you see many monasteries, but then you wonder, well, where are the parishioners and where actually are the monks? Contrary sense, many Europeans often come to the United States, not everywhere in the United States, but certainly places like Birmingham, Alabama, or Dallas, or Louisville, Kentucky, and they said, gee, there's lots of Christians, but where are the cathedrals? And put differently, often in Europe, we've encountered the aftermath of Christendom without the Christians, but in the United States, we experience the absence of Christendom, but with many Christians and other believers of different faiths as well. And this has been the subject of some study. A sociologist, many of you might be familiar with Peter Berger, and some colleagues came out with this a number of years ago. And you can see I stole the title of this for my lecture today, and it's a good book, really looking at the present situation, and I recommend that. But of course, this is the one you really want to buy right here. And as any author will say, even if you don't plan on reading it, you should buy it. Nonetheless, you should consider it. So what are some of the nature of these differences? And some of these will be quite familiar to most of you, maybe some aspects not that familiar, but we could start just with the First Amendment. And most of us here are probably familiar with the its two clauses, the Disestablishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And we're used to this as something that's politically normal, but this is a very radical development in human history, especially when you think of the European state church situation at this time. And to be sure, you know, the church establishments existed at the state level in Massachusetts, where I'm from, up until the 1830s, but this is quite a novel development. Of course, there's a revolution on the other side of the pond in 1789, and thereafter. But one of the distinguishing features of the American Revolution was there was no ancien regime in a religious sense. No, there was not an entrenched powers of the established church. And one scholar has memorably described the American Revolution in religious terms as producing more of a freedom of religion, whereas the French Revolution, not in all cases, but especially in some of the more radical years of the 1790s, freedom from religion. There were no priests beheaded in the American Revolution, but quite a few were beheaded during the French Revolution. And that began to produce sort of different trajectories of development in religio-political matters. And most of you are probably familiar with Alexis de Tocqueville. Hands down, he's the single most quoted European commentator in the United States. He came to this country to study the prison systems in the 1830s, but what he really wanted to write about was democracy and its future. And one of the things that struck him immediately was, upon my arrival in the United States, it was the religious aspect of the country that first struck my eye. As I prolonged my stay, I perceived the great political consequences that flowed from this new state of things. In France, I had seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom almost always move in contrary directions, but in America, I found them united intimately with one another. And, tradition of religious liberty and the type of pluralism it began to produce has led throughout the 19th century and up to our own day to relatively higher levels of religious belief when you do various comparisons between the United States and Western Europe. There are a lot of historical factors for this. I won't go into all of them that I talk about in the book, but certainly the tradition of American revivalism. Those who've taken surveys of American history would have probably encountered the name of Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield and Charles Finney. He's a scary looking guy in the corner. You wouldn't want that guy to be your dad. But this is very important, I think, in shaping American religious dynamics and political dynamics to a certain extent as well. And of course, have to mention, given a recent election, Joseph Smith and the development of Mormonism during this time. Especially, I would want to emphasize the second great awakening. After the United States is on the scene politically, after the First Amendment is a reality, you have this expansion into the frontier and the development of and the proliferation of new groups: the Methodists, the Baptists, Presbyterians, and tent revivals and camp meetings going on at this time. On the continent of Europe, this was not going on at this time. And this sense has produced a great vitality and diversity of religious belief. Actually, I meant to mention a few, probably I think one of the best books on the revivalist spirit in the 19th century and some of its long-term effects is a book by Nathan Hatch, used to be at Notre Dame, now the president of Wake Forest, The Democratization of American Christianity. But you see this today in the variety, the Amish community, mega churches, storefront churches, certainly Catholicism. You see it in statistics. These are Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life numbers from a survey taken in 2011. This is the number of Americans that would say religion is very important to them compared to other Western European countries. And you can certainly see the difference here in the way Americans in demographic terms think of the relationship between religion and morality at some level. Often, let me get my water here. You'll have to forgive me. I've been having this dry mouth problem lately, so I'm going to have to pause every now and then. Often for some foreigners and others, when you speak of American religious dynamics, something like this, oops, there's another statistic, we'll just go over that. Something like this might come to mind. If you'll think of the religious right and that really came to ascendancy in the 1980s and 1990s and their relationship to the GOP, and you can see all the candidates genuflecting to the religious right here. That's part of the story, but I think it's not historically or sociologically accurate to think it's the whole story. Just even with major public figures, you see people across the political spectrum. Martin Luther King, minister, the civil rights movement was suffused with religious fervor. Jimmy Carter, a Democratic president, the word evangelical first kind of came into circulation with a Georgia Democrat. Mike Huckabee, certainly Mitt Romney, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton I could put up, and of course America's best known religious figures, Ned Flanders of the Simpsons. Another distinguishing aspect, just to go back a little bit, to the American Revolution and religious development in the 19th century and political development was the relative lack of stringent anti-clericalism that you saw in Europe. In France, really going back even before the Revolution to the radical Enlightenment, figures such as Voltaire, who famously said, "Crush the infamous thing," in reference to the Catholic Church in France. The philosopher Diderot famously said that freedom would not come to Europe until the last priest was strangled by the guts of the last monarch. And so political modernity, political liberalism, often was the transmitter of a very severe anti-clericalism. And there's some wonderful anti-clerical cartoons from the 19th century. I won't show you all of them, but here's one of a priest teaching, and see there's a picture of the church, but the poor student is getting the math wrong, so he's being led astray. Here's one that is depicting that the clergy are weighing down the Latin peoples. This is a poor commoner, and you have the kind of the fat, wealthy clergyman on top of him. Get that one probably. A lot of anti-clerical fervor was directed against the papacy and after the French Revolution and throughout the 19th century, especially loathed Pope by Republicans, liberals, and secularists of variety stripes was Pope Pius IX, Pio Nono, who was Pope from 1846 up until 1878. And you know, probably one of the strongest contrasts in the creation of a modern nation state that you could draw between the United States and Italy in the 19th century, because as again, I assume many of you probably know this, but that the Pope essentially functioned as a secular monarch, a temporal king, and up until the liquidation of the Papal States in 1860, and eventually the Pope Pius IX considered himself a prisoner of the Vatican until the Concordat with Mussolini in 1929 that created the Vatican State that we know today. So it was there was, you know, great vitriol on both sides. Anti-clericalism among political liberals, but also there was a strong reaction in Europe. You could trace this back to the French Revolution and the creation of a type of conservatism that the United States has never really known, in, at least in a fully expanded form. And that's what I would call a throne and altar conservatism, a crown and church. Many folks wanting to turn the dial back to before 1789. That was a powerful force throughout the 19th century, especially once Napoleon was vanquished in 1815. You have the Restoration, and you have figures like Joseph de Maistre and Chateaubriand, and a number of German Romantic figures and others that really quite longingly look back to the Middle Ages and a symbiotic relationship between church and crown, throne and altar, as a much more desirable than the infection. De Maistre called the revolution, the French Revolution, satanic in its meaning. And again, what I'm sort of getting at here is that let's go to the next. That the U.S. political development in the 19th century never quite had the bandwidth, the breadth of Europe in the 19th century. The United States never developed socialist traditions that developed, you know, after Karl Marx and some of the social democratic parties that come on the scene later in the 19th century, nor did it really have a throne and altar type of conservatism developed in Europe. And these, I put these three figures up because they're pretty influential and representative figures of Europe in circa the middle parts of the 19th century. Of course, Karl Marx and his idea that religion is the opiate of the masses, and it's sort of like the pus of a sick world. And once you finally overturn unjust working conditions, that religion will just peter away eventually, and that was a driving ideology, at least on the far left. A figure like Leon Gambetta in the French Third Republic, who was sort of a person of the center, Republican, but nonetheless, one of his more famous lines is when he stood up in the French Parliament and said, "Clericalism, that's the enemy." And there was a long fight between clerical forces and anti-clerical forces in France in the late 19th century, culminating in the French separation of church and state laws of 1905. But then again, I would call your attention to the far right and Count Metternich, the Austrian architect of the Restoration order, who believed the necessity of state churches, the necessity of throne and throne and altar. Here's another way I illustrated this: that just in the very far left, and of course in the early parts of the 20th century, you have the Bolshevik Revolution and a very destructive type of anti-clericalism. And I use just the Church of Notre Dame to illustrate. Illustrate the far right, but all of those figures really were not functioning in the American religio-political system conditions of the middle 19th century, but they're fairly illustrative of certain European trends. Of course, some that were quite destructive if we go into the 20th century. Excuse me. Oh, does it need to be cut up some? Okay, good. Let me turn to the question now of how American traditions of religious liberty and vitality and the kind of pluralism look through European eyes. And a lot of my research dealt with travelers to the United States, but also those in Europe lecturing on this strange new country that had taken root across the Atlantic. Looking at some European commentators, I think will shed light on the nature of this God gap or Atlantic gap. And I think, historians really shouldn't comment on the present and certainly not the future, they might shed at least some light on some of the disaffections, misunderstandings, anti-Americanism, anti-Europeanism that we've seen in the past few decades. Let me start with the right. And here from the European right, again, the throne and ultra-right, the American experiment and disestablishment often came across as sheer madness, the decentralizing of religion, throwing religious belief to the private judgment of every person seemed like a sheer recipe for social chaos, confusion, and disorder. And this critique of America was pervasive and persistent. And again, I think in some respects, while this type of throne and altar right no longer exists in Europe today, I think in some ways it has continued on. Let me give you a quote now went too fast there. This is actually one of my favorite quotes in the whole book. It's by a Swiss-German theologian named Philip Schaff, and he came to the United States in 1844. He was a native of Switzerland, but he did his studies in Germany at Tübingen and Halle and the University of Berlin. But he wanted to come to kind of work with the German immigrants in the United States, and he changes his position significantly. So later on, I'm going to bring him up as a more centrist figure. But I think, I have his picture later on, but I don't have it here, but I want to give you this quote. When he first came over in 1844, he gave a lecture in Pennsylvania, and the title of it was a book published later called The Principle of Protestantism, and this is how he sized up the United States. Again, keep in mind he's from a state church background. Here you have all the revivals, the Second Great Awakening taking place, frontier expansion, a First Amendment creating the legal conditions of religion in the United States. And here he writes, "Tendencies which have found no political room to unfold themselves in other lands wrought here in the United States without restraint. Thus we have come gradually to have a host of sects which is no longer easy to number, and that still continue to swell from year to year. Such is the aspect of this land, a variegated sampler of all conceivable shimmers and dreams. Every theological vagabond and peddler may drive here his bungling trade without passport of license and sell his false ware at pleasure. What is to come of such confusion is not now to be seen." So, number of other figures and some quotes I'll give you. This is from the famous novelist Anthony Trollope. "For myself, I love the name of state and church and believe that much of our English well-being has depended on it. I have made up my mind to think that union good and not to be turned away from that conviction. I feel very strongly that much of that which is evil in the structure of American politics is owing to the absence of any national religion, and that something also of social evil has sprung from the same cause. His mother, who traveled around the United States in the 1820s and 1830s, arrived at a similar position. "It is impossible, in witnessing all these unseemly vagaries," she wrote, "not to recognize the advantages of an established church as a sort of headquarters for quite unpresuming Christians who are content to serve faithfully without insisting upon each a little separate banner embroidered with a device of their own imagining." I have quite a few of these. So Charles Dickens had something similar to say. He said that the contrarian spirit, basically, of the United States, if they established a church, they would immediately try to disestablish it. Here's a figure you're probably not familiar with, Ferdinand Kornburger, an Austrian novelist, and he wrote a very popular book in 1841 entitled American Müde, sort of weary of America, tired of America. And he has one character, this Dr. Moorfield, in his book, exclaimed the following: "In Europe, where there are established churches, the clergy exists with a fixed and distinguished position and with a feeling of corporate identity. This provides comfort, rendering them often amiable members of society. Things are different here, where the church, as such," this figure is in the United States, "things are different here, where the church, as such, simply does not matter, where religious communities form and dissolve like tea parties, where it is easier to protect a pasture from grasshoppers than keep a religious society together. Here, importance does not rest on churchly authority, but rather on the authority of individual personality. Consequently, among the clergy in America, a nest of Pharisees has been established. The repulsiveness," German term there is the Ekelhaftigkeit, "of which is hard to understand from a European standpoint." I think we'll skip the apostle of high culture, Matthew Arnold. He had some similar reflections. Toward the end of the 19th century, the pope who came after Pope Pius IX actually condemned this sort of vague error heresy called Americanism. And it's still contested exactly what this meant, but it largely applied to certain European clerics who wanted a little more lay involvement in parish life, and wanted to accept some of the principles of religious liberty and religious freedom that had been condemned from popes going really all the way back to the French Revolution, but in a very pronounced way with Pope Gregory the 16th in the 1830s. To summarize the rightist position, or the traditionalist, or the throne and altar position, the traditional critique of America derives from a nostalgia for established churches and a host of attendant pre-democratic, culturally organicist sentiments. The United States, in this view, represented a disquieting departure from a more salutary ecclesiastical establishmentarianism, and a robust exercise of religious freedom was often met warily as an indulgence in subjectivism and individualism, as a kind of a grand bedlam, is Philip Schaff's term, a chaos, confusion, a kind of centrifugal force, this type of democratization of Christianity, as Nathan Hatch called it. And in the shaping this type of social imaginary, or what's going on in the back of their mind, there's sort of this normative benchmark that the confessional situation in Europe going back to 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia, and the state churches in different areas, the Anglican Church, the Lutheran churches, the Prussian Evangelische Church, was sort of the normative benchmark. And the United States was on this kind of bold religious experiment, going in many different directions. And there was, I don't really have this in my paper today, but since I had Joseph Smith up and because of our recent election, enormous curiosity in Europe about Mormonism. Probably the Mormons and the Shakers were two of the really interesting religious phenomena. And I found quite a few European travelers who would come to New England and wanted to go attend a Shaker. Some of y'all wanted to go to two places, to see Niagara Falls and to go to a Shaker community. But a lot of influence, a lot of interest in the development of Mormonism and the story of Joseph Smith and their trek west. And one actually European I have on the, I don't quote him here, but on the secular side, he was very proud of European development. He says, look, you know, while we are kind of getting rid of this superstition over there, they're creating a new, he called it a Mohammedism. They're creating a new, you know, sort of outgrowth of Judeo-Christianity. And that was sort of the put-down term, Mohammedism, that the United States has created in the development of Mormonism. Well, let me turn from the right to the left, and I'll quote myself here. For those who have advocated or assumed the historical normativity of the European route of secularization, which is to say that the French revolutionary model was the more exemplary and with its kind of anti-clerical potency was the benchmark. For those who have advocated or assumed the historical normativity of the European route of secularization, the United States appeared to have taken a peculiar road to modernity, one whose revolution, unlike the French Revolution, congenitally lacked sufficient secularizing impulses. From this vantage point, what distinguished the American system was not so much that it produced religious cultural disarray. Now, that's more the traditionalist criticism that I outlined, but that it preserved variants of dogmatic pre-modern religiosity all too well. Sectarian and obscurantist variants, to be sure, and one stubbornly impervious to enlightenment or elimination. Criticism from the left thus focused more on cultural backwardness, a progressive fear, more than cultural anarchy, a conservative fear. And I looked at some folks from the late 18th century, also the Saint Simonians, or some proto-socialists. And let me just give you, and certainly a number of Marx and Engels and others. Let's go over, we're going to skip here. But here's a Michel Chevalier, a Saint Simonian who traveled to the United States in the 1830s, I believe. His conclusion was the Yankees, the Americans, have carried a retrograde tendency to the greatest extreme. They have, except in some few points, relapsed into Judaism. As the religion of a people regulates their general sentiments and character, the Yankees have thus fallen back into Judaism. They possess, like the Jews, that exclusive spirit which was already inherent in their insular origin. Another figure, any sociology majors here? This is from Auguste Comte, who gives us the term sociology. And he had this sort of vision of history, a three-stage vision of history that kind of went from the theological to the philosophical and finally to the sociological. And his assessment of the United States was the American Revolution was as purely Protestant as the others. In its origin, it represented in new forms the Dutch Revolution. In its final development, it prolonged the English Revolution, which it realizes as far as Protestantism will allow. There is nothing left to be said for its success as a decisive social enterprise, for it has developed to excesses the inconveniences of the critical doctrine. It sanctions more emphatically than any other society the political supremacy of metaphysicians and jurists among a people who pay through their innumerable incoherent modes of worship that lack any genuine social purpose. We'll skip Pierre Proudhon and go to, let's go to Hegel. Hegel's actually an interesting figure. It's hard to know exactly where to classify him, left, right, or center. since I talk a little bit in the book of the influence of his conception of history on Karl Marx, I thought I would offer this quote. I have two. Let me make sure I give you the... every person in America, every person may have his own worldview and his own religion. This explains the proliferation of sects to the point of sheer insanity. Verrücktheit. This total arbitrariness is such that the various communities hire and fire ministers as they please. The church is not something that subsists enduringly in and for itself, but with a substantial spirituality of its own and an external establishment. Instead, religious matters are handled over to the particular view of the congregation. In North America, the wildest freedom of imagination prevails. What is missing is the religious unity found in European states, where deviations are limited to a few confessions. And this comes out of his lectures on the philosophy of history that many many Germans and other Europeans would have heard in the after he came to the University of Berlin in 1817, I believe. Karl Marx, of course, an enormously influential figure. Let's see, I have a slightly longer quote here. Let me read it. North America, he wrote in his essay, The Jewish Question of 1848, is preeminently the country of religiosity. As Beaumont Tocqueville and the Englishman Hamilton assure us in unison. However, the states of North America only serve as an example. The question is, what is the relation between complete political emancipation and religion? If we find in this country, which has attained full political emancipation, that religion not only continues to exist, but is fresh and vigorous, this is proof that the existence of religion is not at all opposed to the perfection of the state. But since the existence of religion is the existence of a defect, the source of this defect must be sought in the nature of the state itself. And if I may gloss that longer quote a little bit, that it was such a firm conviction for him that religion was an opiate of the masses, that it was sort of just ipso facto true that the democratic revolution of the United States, since it hadn't abolished religion, but it seemed to be going up, as Tocqueville and others seem to suggest, that this was a deficient revolution. It was simply a liberal bourgeois revolution that needed superseding by a socialist revolution. And then one further quote from his famous essay, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. The feverishly youthful movement of a matter of production in America has a new world to make its own, has left neither the time nor the opportunity for abolishing the old religious world. I'll give you one more quote here from Jules Grey, a French Third Republican voice. And this was after he had heard some revivalist type preachers not too far from Chicago. He wrote, when hearing about this fabulous exploitation of human gullibility by such preachers, don't ask yourself whether you are not living in the Middle Ages or dealing with some tribe of Sudan. Surely the sociologists will have to understand before they can generalize how one can find in one population the most acute practical sense, the most ruthless and concrete realism, and material and mechanical advances at their highest point of development, coexisting with childlike credulity, illogicality, and hopeless unreason. How can the United States seem to be an industrial powerhouse, but also have this religious vitality? That was troubled him. Max Weber was very interested in this question too, and he's another figure I treat in the book, the relationship between industrialism and capitalist sensibilities and the type of religious dynamics I found. More water. At the end of the day, however, right and left perspectives do not exhaust European perspectives on American religion. I also discuss more centrist views. Tocqueville, I think, would be an example here. But two that I focus on in the book, the first I've already mentioned, the Swiss-German church historian and theologian, Philip Schaff. I have him here. He lived in the United States from 1844 He taught at a little seminary, Mercersburg Seminary in Pennsylvania, and finished his career at Union Theological Seminary, dying in 1893. He actually traveled back 14 times to Europe during his life. And you think about traveling in this period, that's a lot of time and energy. And he actually got me in this project, interested in this project in the first place because of some lectures that he gave on American civilization. I thought, this is an interesting genre. Europeans were kind of going back, trying to explain, this is what's going on over there. And he and others treat the, and certainly Tocqueville, treat the religious dimension quite extensively. But toward the end of his life, even though when he came over in 1844, my earlier quote, he did not have a very sanguine outlook, toward the end of his life, he sort of shifted. The United States has indeed opened a new chapter in church history, which differs widely from the ancient persecution of the church by the state, from the medieval Roman Catholic domination of the state by the church, and from the modern European Protestant subjection of the church to the state. This point should be placed in its proper light and carefully guarded against frequent misrepresentations of European writers who can see nothing but culpable indifferentism in any attempt to emancipate the state from the church and the church from the state. So he really began to appreciate the American tradition of religious liberty. But interestingly, he was also a real ecumenist. He cared about Christian unity and some of the splintering and a lot of the small denominations forming throughout the 19th century. That continued to worry him as well to his dying day. I also treat in the book a and this really kind of there we go as far toward the present as I come. Jacques Maritain, a Catholic philosopher who born in the late 19th century, but really was in the early decades of the in the middle decades of the 20th century where he made his career. And offer a quote from him: "A European who comes to America is struck by the fact that the expression separation between church and state does not have the same meaning here and in Europe. In Europe, it means that complete isolation which derives from century-old misunderstandings and struggles and which has produced most unfortunate results. Here it meant, as a matter of fact, together with a refusal to grant any privilege to one religious denomination in preference to others and to have a state-established religion, a distinction between the state and the churches which is compatible with good feeling and mutual cooperation." And he was really a key figure, you know, why the magisterium, popes you know, throughout the 19th century were very critical, very wary of religious freedom. It was through Jacques Maritain, and especially an American American Jesuit theologian, John Courtney Murray, that helped bring about the what I think is a very altered, modified position on religious liberty at the time of Vatican II and the decree on religious liberty. And actually both John Courtney Murray and Jacques Maritain, I'm simplifying greatly here, but they said something to the effect of the type of aggressive liberalism and its yoking with anti-clericalism you saw in the Italian peninsula that stripped the papal states. Now, that's not necessarily the final word on religious liberty. Here in the United States, even though they have all these kind of quackos and different revivalist groups going on and how many thousands of groups of Protestantism, there's actually kind of a workable. It's not freedom from religion that's being advocated. It's a type of freedom of religion and understood in that respect. Maritain and John Courtney Murray were quite influential in bringing the Catholic Church around to that that position. Well, let me just offer a few things by way of summary. What I hope to do, get across in this book. The first is simply just remember religion in transatlantic history, Atlantic history. There's been a real interest in moving away from nation-state history toward looking at transnational history, and Atlantic history has been part of that historiographical trend. Most famously, probably a figure like Bernard Bailyn and his Atlantic history seminar at Harvard University. A lot of this is looked at things like going back to the 18th century, early 19th century, the slave trade and economic and cultural history. What I'm trying to add in my work is that let's think about transatlantic transatlantic comparative religious history, if you want a niche, a word for a specialization. I am pleased to say that I recently got a call from David Hempton, who is the dean of Harvard's Divinity School, and I learned that he and a fellow at the University of Birmingham, Hugh McLeod, have received a grant to do, I think the name of their grant, I'm going to be working with him a little on it, but it's European and American secularization patterns, 1750 to 2000. So I'm looking forward to continuing that. I think, looking at the religious domain doesn't explain, some of the transatlantic tensions and difficulties, anti-Americanism, if you will. But I think sometimes beneath that, there is sort of this long-standing concern. And it's not just of the secular, the secular Europe and religious America. I put the question mark in my title for a reason. And I think Peter Berger, sociologist, might go a little too far down the line of saying that's what's going on here. I think certainly from the more secular side of the religio-political spectrum, there's worries about the type of religiosity in the United States. But at the same time, I think what I was most struck by in my research was the vehemence and persistence of the what I would call the far right, the throne and altar, that type of worry about the United States is just kind of open the door to every man. I think that's even outlived its genesis. One sort of metaphor I use in my conclusion, I have another quote here, but let me just explain it. And I draw this from the political theorist Hugh Hacklow, who I believe is at George Mason University, and he talks about sort of the French Revolutionary model was more of sort of a zero-sum game, that if political modernity was going to come to a place like France that had, an entrenched clergy, an entrenched church, it was perceived that the type of secularism generated is much more a type of take-no-prisoner secularism that developed at the time. And the United States, where there's certainly a fastidious separation of church and state, remarkably, there's always been this, and I think as Tocqueville very astutely recognized, that there's always been this kind of influence that kind of goes between the two, even though in a strictly legal sense there is a separation. And I think I'll call it there. I'll leave you with a cliffhanger. Rethinking secularism in Europe is another concluding point I was going to make. But why don't we just call it there? And time for Q&A. Sorry.
I'll take some time for Q&A. If I may ask the first question, what I find myself wondering as I listen to you speak is you framed the talk in the First Amendment, and we're returning to it again at the end. And I'm curious, the various sort of innovations and entrepreneurial religions that emerged so much in the 19th century, was there much of that sort of activity prior to the founding of the Republic? Or another way of saying that, I guess, would be, how much causal agency do you ascribe to the First Amendment in all the experimentation that happened in 19th century America? Did it just sort of uncork an energy that was already there?
That's a great question, and the easy way to answer, I would say, no, I'm really a European historian. I don't go back that far in the United States, but certainly, if you think of the Quakers, you think of a figure like Roger Williams and Rhode Island. I think there's the First Amendment just doesn't pop out of nowhere. But both theoretically, in figures like Ben and Roger Williams, it's there beforehand. But also just because of just the enormous amount of religious diversity that had developed by the time of the 1790s, it was just impractical to establish a church state. So I think it's the some theoretical beginnings, and
just the landscape of diversity that you would have, the Anglicans in Virginia, Puritans, Baptists, beginning at this time, made an expedient, which then really, concurrently happening with in the following decades, frontier expansion made that the legal norm, the legal conditions that allowed that. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Some other questions. Do European scholars, as they reflect on this issue, recognize that there wasn't a separation of church and state at the state level, that we had established churches, and then do they recognize that throughout the 19th century, the state did teach a kind of non-sectarian, as they called it, religion, Christianity and Christian morality? It seems to me that none of the quotes that you had seem to pick up the fact that in education, right from the beginning, we've had established religion. And it continues, some scholars would argue today, in a form of an established secular religion. So it seems to me their comments seem to reflect the lack of awareness of what's really happening, of what really happened and is happening in America.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to generalize about European scholars as a whole. I would say I think most would recognize the First Amendment as being, pretty progressive, pretty vanguard. But there was, established churches up until the state level, up until the 1830s, and the Constitution, it makes no, provision, trying to abolish these from the beginning. And there was a lot of Protestant, pan-Protestant religiosity, throughout the 19th century. And certainly that's one of the reasons for the backlash against Catholic immigration that begins to increase in the late 19th century. Where I live in Boston, there are a lot of conflicts with Catholics and Protestants over the mandatory reading of the King James Bible. So that's, that's endured. In some levels, but I think you can argue, going back to the jurisprudence in the 1940s and certainly in the 1960s to the present, there's been more of an aggressive secularism felt in the United States that might tilt in the European direction a little bit. At the same time, what I was going to mention, or an aspect of what I was going to mention, that last point. It is interesting to see, especially as many European countries kind of wrestle with the Muslim minorities, and how do you deal with that? There are a number of French sociologists that are using the term they use is laïcité, laicism, and it sort of implies this, almost a religious or kind of very militant secularism, and that's often very disagreeable to Muslim communities, so that they're actually speaking of sort of laicism or secularity, American style, and even the just to move to a completely different country, Turkey, which sort of modeled in the secular reforms of Kemal Atatürk in the 1920s, that was a very draconian imposition of a type of secularism that was sort of plagiarized from the French 1905 model that Prime Minister Erdogan in some of his past writing said we need to get to a laicism American style, that we want to figure some way to, where it was not just secularism enforced by the military and all the Muslims sort of shunted into other part of life. We have to figure out some via media, some middle way, and that's a term that we use with American style secularism. Other questions?
Okay. Do any of the European writers, as you move on into the 20th century, do they tie in their sort of snobbishness towards American religion and so on? In a sense, there's almost a kind of dark humor that Europe
became extreme in their anti-Semitism and revolutions. And in a wonderful sort of way, America's avoided much of that kind of extremism. But as you use those quotes in the kind of sense of superiority, it just struck me that in a way, the demons were being let loose.
Yeah.
And Europe, you know, if you look, particularly in after World War II and so on, it's so bizarre in a way. Do they sense any of that connection at all?
And just by that connection, if I can just amplify.
Well, the fact that they were so belittling of the fact that America rested morality and so on to some degree on religious convictions, and they, at least the intelligentsia, went more with the radical secularism.
Yeah.
But look at the results that came out of it.
Again, it's hard to generalize, but I think some would be aware. You want to be a little careful that people often make judgments from their particular social and political standpoint. And if you assume the state church model, which again persists today in Germany and in many European countries, although it's, you know, just a ghost of its former self, the type of perversion of religiosity, you know, the development of Mormonism, this does come across as a strange draw to you, and that it's just not the right benchmark. It's not, and you know, from the left, if you take the French Revolutionary model or the model of the Italian Risorgimento and its anti-clericalism, that sort of history moves, you know, the logic of history is there's the pre-modern Dark Ages, and then there's the Revolution, and then you have secularization into the future. That becomes, to use a term by Charles Taylor, that's kind of part of the social imaginary, and that's your benchmark. And when you look at the United States and you say, well, I'll give you a very specific story. A good friend of mine, a German woman, I asked her at the University of Virginia when we were grad school together, tell me something just indicative. What's interesting, you know, revealing about America to you? And the story she said was, when I was a teenager, I was out on the West Coast, and I was staying with this woman, an evangelical Christian, who lived in the 1990s. And she told me about this prayer journal she kept on her computer. And she said, what really was bothering me was this computer was more advanced than any I'd seen in Germany at the time. And this idea of sort of advanced technology and keeping and logging a prayer journal and your, you know, latest, she said, what do we do with this? It just was not part of her social imaginary that modernity should have turned out this way in California. You know, just that was, and this, that's the, you know, thing she was trying to figure out. I think I've wandered from your question a little bit. Certainly, one point I was going to make, and I've often been asked about, well, where is this old throne and altar, crown and church conservatism? I mean, you find it in, you know, corners and niches and some nostalgia for, you know, the age of monarchy. But, you know, probably, you know, because many of these figures made their peace with fascism in the 1920s and 1930s, once that was massively discredited through the Holocaust and the war, that was, you know, virtually eliminated. But again, I think some of the sensibilities of a type of supercilious that, you know, the European model is kind of the provides some kind of normative benchmark, you know, continues in some ways in the type of sometimes you even see it on sort of the far left, kind of a Marxist reading of history spiced with a kind of aristocratic hauteur as you look across the Atlantic. Yep, in the back here, behind the crowd.
So basically, we are talking about two borders. To me, I find it quite disturbing. When I first came to America, it's like church, there are so many churches.
Yeah.
I find it very disturbing. So, my question is actually, what kind of model for a church do you have in mind that is actually very good in a practical sense?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
So my question is, what kind of a church is what kind of model for the churches are a good model in a very practical sense?
Okay, very Well, that's what we historians would call a normative question, and we don't answer those because you're asking to tell how something should be, and we only tell you how something something was, and then you're immediately into theological questions and should they have views on this or that. Maybe just in light of what I said, I would say, answer a normative question like this after a historical lecture. Certainly one that's peace loving. Certainly one that sort of practices piety as they understand it. I certainly would be a proponent of the type of religious freedom that Jacques Maritain and others advocated in Vatican II's document on its decree on religious freedom. But,
question is, it seems very Christian-based in this model. Is secularism the same? Does it have that same gap between Judaism in Europe and Judaism in the United States?
Could you elaborate a little bit?
Do you see that there is more secularism in the Jewish communities in Europe than there is in the Jewish communities in the United States?
Yeah, I think an honest answer to that would be I really don't know. I mean, there are different demographics and certainly different political and historical circumstances in some ways, but I don't know. But I don't really suspect that much. I mean, certainly much fewer Jews in the United States and in Europe than in the United States today. So you probably have a larger spectrum in the United States. Number three.
it's such an interesting topic. Do any of the European critics during that period openly recognize that secularism functions as a religion? If you go back to John Dewey and a whole cadre of American atheist humanists, they openly recognized that they were presenting new religious ideas, as they called them. It was a religion for a scientific and enlightened and liberated world. Do European secularists use that kind of language, that they are really establishing, in a functional sense, another religion?
Sort of ersatz religiosity or functions, and giving a coherent worldview and a teleology of history.
Well,
if you go back to
Durkheim, if you look at Dewey, if you look at a whole range of thinkers, they make that point. Yeah. In the American context, Dewey would be especially notable.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that if you view religion functionally as that dimension of culture that addresses the ultimate questions of meaning and purpose and so on, Marx would be a religious figure in that sense. Do they ever talk about that?
No, a good question. Very explicitly, and like some of the Saint Simonians in France and Auguste Comte, I mean, toward the end of his life, it gets a little bizarre, and he understands, what he's doing is just kind of forming a type of religion. And he speaks of the French Revolution as sort of the great purgative that purges everything. And what had happened after the French Revolution was there was just, kind of chaos. There was Napoleon. What Europe needed was a kind of a coherent worldview. And for Auguste Comte, there was a vision of history that moved from the theological to the metaphysical to the scientific rational, and that was presented in very religious terms. And he actually had a certain fondness for Catholicism in France because it had served that function for humanity, and he saw himself part prophet of science, but as a religious prophet in some sense of bringing a kind of a people finally need coherence, and he could provide it in that sense, to the sense of using priest and having high priest, and that was where a kind of scientism blends into a cultism in a way. That's why in that quote I gave you, he was so disturbed by Protestantism. He admired Catholicism because it provided kind of unity, and French Revolution had blown that away, and he kind of traced the French Revolution back to Protestantism, just as Martin Luther had challenged religious authority. So the French Revolution had done that, and the seeds of revolution had, you know, incubated since the time of the Reformation, spread into France through Jansenists and, you know, crypto-Calvinists that were kind of laying the seeds for the great purgative, as he called it. So he did see himself as restoring a type of cultural coherence and unity through his writing. Durkheim in the late 19th century, I mean, Durkheim was a great, you know, we use the term culture wars, but my goodness, in France in the Third Republic between the, you know, the far right, the Catholic, and the more anti-clerical Republicans, Durkheim, you know, why he, you know, believed religion was just hocus pocus and superstition, he believed that there had to become that sort of kind of unifying civic ideology. And I know less about Dewey in the United States, but it was that he saw that sort of, you know, perpetual, you know, destruction, undermining, that somehow the human spirit could not endure that, and it had to, and there had to be folks like himself, enlightened social scientists and political figures that would actually serve that function again. So he's very concerned about, you know, cultural disarray and, you know, some of those things that would be on the, you know, he's probably, and that's why in my book it's sometimes hard to categorize people. They would be, you know, on the what we would call the secular side of things, but they would kind of have the same worries as the throne and altar people. And I found that kind of fascinating, how that is kind of almost a backdoor. The French have a phrase, les institutions, that extremes touch, that in some sense the conservative critique and the secular critique, kind of, you know, the left and the right kind of come together in a concern with cultural coherence. And that was kind of the problem of the United States. It just seemed like a grand bedlam. You know, here this country, it's spreading, it's industrializing, they're founding new religions like Mormonism, and there was some real misgivings and worries about them.
We should move toward wrapping up, though before we do, your answer to the last question occasionally gave another question for me, if I may, which is that I'm curious whether you think that movements in 19th century America, reform movements like, say, temperance or the Sabbath movement, had a special purchase here, because there were concerns about the sort of centrifugal aspect of all this religious innovation and disestablishment, and there was a concern to find something that would hold it all together, more so than later.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And I mean, this is a point that Nathan Hatch makes, that, you know, at the time, if you have this profusion and religious vitality, but it's often not coming from the government. It's often kind of, it's often women, you know, in the case of the temperance movement, you know, people on the frontier just kind of drinking too damn much. And we have to, you know, we're not gonna have a civilization if we can, you know, control that. Certainly the Sabbath movement. One group I look at is after 1848, you know, there was another kind of eruption of the French Revolution that occurred in Europe in 1848. And eventually, the powers that be, state churches and monarchs, were able to reestablish control in 1850. But a lot of these 1848ers, as they were called, kind of fled to the United States because they, you know, could come over here and get land cheaply. But for the German 1848ers, you know, when they would come and, you know, encounter these, you know, these temperance and, you know, these laws, they just hated that. They drank beer and, you know, they would encounter that type of, you know, Puritan. This is, you know, how the term kind of the American Puritanism. These people are still Puritans here, and still just backward people. H.L. Mencken actually studied under a number of the German 1848ers, and a lot of kind of the diatribes he has against sort of American Puritanism. These backwater people kind of derived from some of the German 1848ers who were very worried about the legacy of Puritanism, especially was often felt in Sabbath laws, blue laws, and temperance movements that would break out. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. If there are no further questions, please join me in a